This episode is brought to you by Thorn, and I have some incredible news for any of you that are in the military, first responder, or medical professions. In an effort to give back, Thorn is now offering you an ongoing 35% off each and every one of your purchases of their incredible nutritional solutions. Now, Thorn is the official supplement of CrossFit, the UFC, the Mayo Clinic, the Human Performance Project, and multiple special operations organizations. I myself have used them for several years, and that is why I brought them on as a sponsor. Some of my favorite products they have are their Multivitamin Elite, their Whey Protein, the Super EPA, and then most recently, Cinequil. As a firefighter, a stuntman, and a martial artist, I've had my share of brain trauma and sleep deprivation, and Cinequil is their latest brain health supplement. Now, to qualify for the 35% off, go to thorn.com, thorne.com. Click on sign in and then create a new account. You will see the opportunity to register as a first responder or member of military. When you click on that, it will take you through verification with GovX. You'll simply choose a profession, provide one piece of documentation, and then you are verified for life. From that point onwards, you will continue to receive 35% off through Thorn. Now, for those of you who don't qualify, there is still the 10% off using the code BTS10, behind the shield 10, for a one-time purchase. Now, to learn more about Thorn, go to episode 323 of the Behind the Shield podcast with Joel Totoro and Wes Barnett.
Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show Army veteran, Boston firefighter, and punk rock vocalist Michael McColgan. So in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics from his early life, the invasion of Iraq, the formation of the Dropkick Murphys, his journey into the fire service, his powerful addiction story, helping the Boston Fire Department with their mental health, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of almost 1,000 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Michael McColgan. Enjoy.
Well, Michael, I want to start by saying two things. Firstly, thank you so much to our mutual friend, Nocco Nolan, who has connected me with some amazing people, and you are the most recent. So thank you, Nocco. And secondly, I want to welcome you onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
James, thanks for having me. And I'd also like to give a big shout out to Nocco Nolan. And he's a great friend and somebody that I've learned a lot from relative to wellness and, you know, de-escalation techniques and just living skillfully. He's a great, great person.
He is. I think he's, you know, that world's most interesting man. Like almost everyone I know that I've met through this podcast, they also know Nocco. So he's fascinating.
Yeah, I think that's valid. He is definitely the world's most interesting man.
All right. Well, where on planet Earth are we finding you this evening?
Well, I'm in Dorchester, Massachusetts. To right now, and it's where I live. I work for the Boston Fire Department as Employee Assistance Program Counselor. I've worked as a firefighter and a dispatcher as well. And being on the Boston Fire job, most members of the job live in Boston proper, not all. I find it wise to do so because I mean it's a job where emergency management could evolve at a moment's notice. So yeah, that's where I'm at tonight.
Well, I'd love to start at the very beginning of your story, and obviously we'll work through all these different roles that you've held. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings.
Sure. Born at St. Margaret's Hospital. I'll just do the thing. April 6, 1970. And my father worked for the MBTA, Massachusetts Busing and Transit Authority, as a track laborer, and then later on became a foreman of the Green Line track labor crew. And my mom, you know, worked for a bookstore, Barnes and Nobles, and then she wound up working after that for the Boston Transportation Department at City Hall. And my brother Donald actually is a union plumber out of Local 12. He works at Harvard University as an in-house plumber. And so that's a little background about where I was born and, you know, what my family has done for work. And then extended family, like aunts and uncles and cousins, are all involved in trades and, you know, organized labor, healthcare and teaching. So, you know, growing up here in Dorchester, Massachusetts, which is part of Boston, it's, you know, politics and, you know, being part of the labor movement was sort of like a birthright. You're in whether you want to be or not.
There's a beautiful irony that an Ivy League school needs a tradesman to keep it running.
Yeah, just to think my brother's guidance counselor told him he'd never get to Harvard University. You know, there he is.
I was thinking the same thing. Yeah, this is interesting because obviously, you know, you've got certain professions where that kind of college makes sense, but there are so many where I think, you know, these poor, you know, young men and women are left with these massive debts with degrees that don't lead to a career. And I think, you know, you and I obviously in our, certainly in the fire service and in paramedic for me as well, that was trade school, you know, and you are literally out in the world saving lives. So I think, I hope this is the kind of era where we invest a lot more time and money into trades again, because, you know, the purely academic route works for, you know, true professionals, lawyers and doctors and engineers. But I think there's a lot of, you know, disillusioned students with massive debt that it really didn't do anything for.
No, agreed. I have people I grew up with and friends who went the academia route and took on, you know, a significant amount of student loans, and you know, the job market was tenuous and difficult for them. And I, like I had stated earlier, like a lot of people in my family and even friends beyond that were in you know, the trades, building trades, as pipe fitters, electricians, laborers, iron workers, etc. And, you know, plumbers, they have work, you know, and if it's not commercial work, you know, some tradespeople can get right into residential side. And yeah, like technical schools and trades and things like that, I feel like are always going to be required and needed. So, you know, making those pathways available to students in schools, more widely available, or talking about that earlier would probably be a good thing.
I'm going to go on a massive tangent now, but it's an interesting perspective because you've got a lot of family members and friends that are in professions that have unions as well. The kind of leadership in our IAFF now obviously has become Boston-centric as opposed to Virginia-centric before. And what I have seen in my career is, you know, I adore the union philosophy. All of us together fighting for better working, you know, conditions and safer working environments. But at times it's been abused. And I think the previous leadership in the IAFF, you know, we discovered there's some pretty massive abuse at the top. When you look at all these professions and all these labor unions, the ones that you're familiar with, which ones are doing it right? And what are some of the mistakes that are being made by certain unions in the fire service that aren't producing the kind of improving working environment that we should be seeing?
I think sadly, you know, with power comes a abuse of it. And the leadership that preceded the current leadership in the IAFF, you know, definitely, you know, got unskillful with financial resources. That's been well documented. I feel like the newer leadership is doing an exceptional job of accounting for every red cent that comes in and goes out, and that should be how it is all the time. And I feel like, you know, with building trades, and even like the Teamsters, for example, you know, there's been problematic behavior at the top before. At this time, 2024, I think a lot of the general membership, whether it be in the Teamsters or the IAFF or building trades, want more accountability and more transparency. And I feel like the leadership now has to open everything up and put that forward. So I feel like in 2024 versus, let's say, 1984, 1994, 2004, it's better.
Excellent. Yeah, I think, I mean, even nationally, I mean, I was talking to Tulsi Gabbard recently, and you just see the false economy. Like, for example, healthcare in this country, you don't have to be a Harvard graduate economist to understand that if you make your country healthier, it will cost less to take care of them. You know what I mean? And that's been completely missed both sides of the aisles for, you know, decades now. So I hope that this is going to be, you know, in our own union and obviously nationally as well, that we're going to hold people accountable and start demanding proactive solutions. You know, and for example, this is the dead horse that I flog all the time. You know, Boston, correct me if I'm wrong, you work a 42-hour work week?
Where I'm working, I'm attached to headquarters. I work like a 40-hour work week. But, you know, we're on call constantly with employee assistance. We have a full-time employee assistance program, and then we're tied in with CISM and peer support. Fire suppression and fire alarm, the dispatch side, have a platoon schedule, group schedule, four groups, and typically have like a 48-hour work schedule per week.
Right. Yeah. See, this is what I hope that as a profession we will do is we'll get that down to 40, you know, 42, you know, ABCD, ABCD. Because again, you know, working conditions and, you know, sleep are massive things in other unions, shipping and aviation and trucking. And, you know, it's something I hope that we'll catch up on.
You brought up Tulsi Gabbard earlier and talking about keeping people healthy, and that would like bring down overall health care costs in the U.S. I completely agree with that. And that goes just beyond physical health. That gets into wellness, that gets into mental health, and, you know, trumpeting that and amplifying that and offering that for people of all professions or folks from all walks of lives is huge. And, you know, it's better to have that ounce of prevention and, you know, fitness and wellness and things of the like on the front end as opposed to what it costs on the back end. And that's, I think, been a big problem in the U.S.
Absolutely. Well, I want to go back to your timeline. So when you were kind of school age, sports and exercise, what were you playing and doing?
So I think, you know, like when I was a teenager, I think I was playing like intramural basketball at high school, not on the varsity team. I didn't have the chops or the skills for that. Like playing floor hockey, but St. Brendan's Parish. And I think, you know, prior to that, I also played Little League 2 baseball. So I wasn't, you know, my story, I wasn't like a an exceptional athlete, but I can recall, like, growing up playing Little League and then playing intramural sports in high school, and I feel like that kept us out of trouble, like being engaged and active in that stuff. And sadly, I mean, this is just an opinion. I mean, a lot of people have very, different opinions. It seems like technology, smartphones and things of the like, it seems like maybe they've taken kids away from that, and they're more like caught up in, what's going on in social media and things of the like.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I've always said that kids and dogs are the same. You know, you've got to exercise them. You've got to do things that test their mind. So you can't just walk a dog. You know, you got to throw the ball and, do some commands, give them some things to actually work on their brain. And, the opposite was COVID. Look how so many people felt when they were cooped up and all they could do was watch TV, and, people started losing their minds. So, I mean, we've done this great social experiment to show the damaging element of some of these devices on our children. And they're amazing. They have amazing application when used sensibly. But if you babysit through a tablet, you end up with these kids that are, 14, 15 years old with spines like an 80-year-old, or obese or no muscle tone. And one day you're hoping they're going to be soldiers and firefighters, and, they can't. They're the pool. They're not even going to be in that pool of candidates. So we're doing a massive disservice to, them to be able to be the professions that maybe they dreamed of. And then obviously their longevity as well.
Yeah, I agree 100% with that. And, I work in addiction with the fire department, like as a employee assistance program counselor. And, addiction isn't just booze and drugs. It could be, it could be gambling, sex, shopping, and technology. Those phones are a new frontier in addiction. And, a lot of process addictions, like gambling, like sex, like shopping, they have recovery programs. But the phones will be the next frontier. And I agree with you 100%. People are becoming beholden to it and addicted to it. And I mean, you've probably heard this too, like the same dopamine that booze and drugs would give to somebody is what people experience when they get hits on social media or likes or things of the like. So I really feel like as time goes on, there'll be possibly 12-step groups or other programs for the phones.
Another area that you don't normally hear people talk about, and it just, again, I've been on an 8-year journey of almost 1,000 conversations. So I'm, constantly learning and kind of reforming my not opinions, but the way I think. But the, what we used to affectionately refer to as the overtime whore, the addiction to working so that you don't have to process the things that are sitting in the back of your mind.
100%. And I've fell into that as far as at work, to absolutely 100% is if I hurl myself into hours and take as many as I can, and I just stay inside this bubble, I don't have to deal with anything else. And I found in my own direct experience, it didn't work. It was maladaptive. Just like, I'm in recovery from booze and drugs. I've been sober since 1992. And, and I've seen addiction manifest in other ways in my life too. And addiction is a maladaptive way to try to deal with, complicated emotions or loss or grief, and it doesn't work. What I've found in my own direct experience in my own life over the last 5 years, and earlier you mentioned COVID, like COVID was a reset for me in a way, because prior to it, I'd started to get into, get into Buddhism and Dharma. And that kind of, and all throughout COVID, I got way more and more into it, because it was informing me, or advising me or inviting me to see that wellness and recovery is an inside job. It's not external. Like chasing sense pleasures to deal with afflictive emotions or grief or the stress of the job, it doesn't work. And I found that meditation, mindfulness, is a very, very good way to kind of slow down, take a breath, observe, and pause. And this is good for the job. It's good off the job. And you can learn to skillfully respond as opposed to knee-jerk reactions and lose your mind or get angry.
I had a guy on, Jim Poole, probably just over a year ago now. I was introduced to a thing called NUCALM, N-U-C-A-L-M. And it used to be the real backstory. There was an incredibly intelligent American scientist, neuroscientist, I think he was. And he spent, I think, 15 plus years trying to figure out the frequency of the brain at the different emotional states. Then he spent another 10 years figuring out, can you make the brain go into those states? Can you influence it? And what he came up with was this machine, and you put on a face mask and headphones and you sit there and you're listening to music, but underneath is this kind of undulation of all these kind of frequencies. And because smartphones, again, saying the good things of technology, because they've become so incredible now it's an app. Same exact thing. So you put the headphones that you got on now, an eye mask, and there's one called Power Nap, which is 20 minutes, and then there's Rescue, which is 20 minutes all the way through to like 100. And it down-regulates the nervous system. It is amazing. And that, along with meditation, I find has worked so well. And if you want to punctuate between a shift and going home, you just go back to the bunk room for 20 minutes, throw that on, or in your car in the parking lot, and you feel like you had a couple of hours sleep, and it just takes you from that kind of hypervigilant down to kind of USA, pseudo flow state. That is something that a lot of people haven't heard of, but truly, truly amazing. And it's not just something, like a Spotify playlist. This is like a 1 gig file per track or per session that you do. So the things you don't hear that are really doing the magic, it's absolutely phenomenal. But again, it's the same thing. It's down regulate and it's working on the inside, as you said, not the outside.
Yeah. And I'm finding, relative to meditation, that there's more receptivity and open-mindedness in the fire service with the younger members than, say, for instance, the older members of the job. And I think when you explain or reflect on, meditation isn't like, it's not siege mentality. It isn't like picking Buddhism over Catholicism, or you're not walking away from your faith or anything like that. It's a philosophy. It's something you can use to, like you say, bring that hypervigilance down, and mindfulness-based stress reduction can bring stress down. And, and as far as anxiety or depression and things of the like, mindfulness or meditation can bring you back to where your feet are at. And you can use mantras or words in seated meditation or walking meditation. For example, walking meditation is something that's a skillful means. Like if you're doing, housework around the firehouse, cleaning up and everything, you could, when you put your left foot down, you could be like here and then your right foot now. So if your mind's like trying to run all over the place or proliferate, you can always just bring it back to the moment. And a lot of, firefighters that I've spoken with about this have found, direct experience benefit from using it. I think a lot of us now in this day and age conceptually hear about it and that it can change neural pathways and you can find some ease and calm and things of the like, or be with the life that's here, like pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, whatever's going on. It's another thing when you invite people to use it and then they use it and then they find benefit. So you know, in my job as a counselor, like offering that up, there's more receptivity, and it feels like it's you know, as with everything changing, and I feel like more people are open to it.
100%. Yeah, I like Headspace, that app as well, because you're getting a pseudo-guided, but the more you do it, the less he talks. You know, you get more and more used to being quiet. But I think this is the commonality. And I personally like the philosophy of, you know, just taking the kind of common denominators of all the faiths and taking that as my personal doctrine. And if you look at pretty much all the faiths, there's a form of prayer, which is arguably meditation. Now, sometimes it's become asking for more money, or it's come a little distorted, but I think ultimately it was just, you know, quieting your mind. But no matter what the faith was, I think that was the underlying reason for prayer.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that 100%, because, you know, not that I'm a religious major's study or, you know, bachelor's of science or PhD in any of it, just in my own direct experience looking at Buddhism or Hinduism or Catholicism, Stoicism, Taoism, Taoism, there's so much interconnectivity and similarity in living skillfully, quieting the mind, concentrating on mantras, concentrating on your breathing and body scan and feeling tones and being the witness to thoughts, feelings, emotions, sensations as they arise and cease, and realizing that a feeling isn't a fact and a thought isn't a commandment, that everything's transient and it comes and it goes. So I think when you invite people to try meditation, and you kind of indicate to them that there isn't a right or wrong way to do it, what you're doing is just like watching what's going on and learning to turn toward anything that's going on, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and kind of being taking that witness position. And I found that people that have receptivity and are trying it are gaining some benefit from it. And it's really counterinstinctual for a lot of members on our job when I first unpack that and say, you know, there's no right or wrong way to do it. You just do it and like let go. Because of our conditioning and upbringing, there's a right way and a wrong way to do something.
Yeah, and an immediate result.
So that can be a stumbling block at first. But when people try and they have receptivity and they kind of soften and let go a little bit, they can kind of just find some ease and some calm and try to, you know, like I said earlier, it's like that acronym, STOP, like slow down, take a breath, observe, and pause. That's something that I feel like when I had been invited to do that, that was super, super helpful for me.
Going back to the school age again, what about music? What was the kind of power of that in your life? And were you playing any instruments or kind of wanting to sing at that point?
I think when I was in eighth grade, I heard The Clash. The first album by The Clash, I heard the first song, Clash City Rockers. And in that moment, I knew that Michael Jackson and Prince and all the things that I'd been listening to, although very good, it was over. I just intuitively felt like, okay, there's meat on the bone here. This band, it just struck a nerve and resonated with me. And then I was sort of like, from that moment on, I started looking at liner notes and lyrics, and like I got geeky about it. Like I just couldn't have a record and just spin it and be casual. I wanted to know where it was made, who the producers, you know, what the lyrics meant. And of course, you know, when you read lyrics and you hear music, it, in my own direct experience, it's always been, okay, like, I assign a meaning to it. And with The Clash, you know, that first album, the Green Album, made me go get Give Them Enough Rope, and, you know, their finest album, London Calling, Sandinista, Combat Rock. And, you know, from there it was The Jam, The Sex Pistols, even like Stiff Little Fingers. And it just, and even U2, early U2 was, you know, more like punkish and rabble-rousing and more rebel music. And one thing, too, that I found was some of the Irish music I've been listening to in, you know, my uncle's or aunt's kitchen in Savin Hill, there was interconnectivity with punk rock and even like a band like the Pogues. And I just got really into music, and I started writing band names on my school books. Like, you know, I would take, you know, I'd put covers over my books, and, you know, The Clash, you know, Stiff Little Fingers, like Sex Pistols. And I dreamt, I'm like, I'd love to be able to be like these guys and say something that was substantive and not all lovey-dovey. And fortunately, because of recovery, I got to make some music and to, you know, open my heart and open my mind and just pour out what my direct experience in life, you know, kind of informed me to write about or sing about. And I've been extremely, extremely fortunate to, like, have been in Dropkick Murphys to make the Boys on the Dock EP, the Do or Die album, and then with Street Dogs, you know, getting to make like 6 studio albums. It's, you know, super, super grateful. Like, I don't think it's a right. I kind of consider it a privilege. So that was that. The Clash was the formative thing. That changed the whole game.
I was a big Michael Jackson fan when I was younger too, but now when I look back, I don't remember The Clash grooming children at the Neverland Ranch, so you probably chose the right path.
So too.
Well, when you talked about sobriety, if I done my math right, you were 22 when you began that journey. When you look back now, talk to me about the kind of struggles that you had when you were younger and what sent you into addiction, because I think this is a big part of the first responder mental health story that we miss, is what happened to us before we put the uniform on, our formative years.
Yeah, so, you know, I started drinking at a really young age, and it's like absolutely absurd when I reflect on it, like when I was 12 years old. And I became a weekend warrior pretty quickly, in junior high and then all throughout high school. So before I graduated high school, like, you know, now obviously looking through a sober lens and having recovery, it's my sense, you know, I was pretty mired in alcoholism at that point. Then joined the military, and it really took off because in the Army, like I went to basic training, AIT, one station unit training, and then in the AIT section of basic training, on weekends we got, you know, some liberty. We could, you know, we could go to like the enlisted members club, and then there was booze there. And I was like, I remember that first weekend liberty, I was just like drinking obscene amounts of beer. Like we got, I went into this enlisted members club at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, called the KSAN, named after a battle in Vietnam. And I paid $5 and I had an empty milk gallon and I could just fill it all night long off the tap. And, you know, it had been like 8 weeks since I had drank, and, you know, it just took off. And I remember blacking out that night. And from that point on with drinking, you know, blackouts were a part of my experience, particularly when I like got to permanent duty station in Germany. And, you know, Germany had bars that didn't close at 2 a.m. It was around the clock. So my drinking just really took off and hit another gear. And it's miraculous that I didn't get booted out of the military. Like, my father, God rest his soul, used to say, God looks out for drunks and children. And, you know, I wound up getting out of the military with an honorable discharge. And then I got back home. I had a job waiting for me at a newspaper in Boston, and before I even entered the building, I was drinking a six pack. That first shift, I was drinking on the job and off the job. And so it was, that led me up to, you know, I was mired in pretty heavy alcoholism. And as far as drugs went, if they were around, I wasn't saying no. And, you know, it just wasn't. And, you know, I think it was my father who was really pivotal, because he was in recovery, in helping me get to recovery when I was 22. And, you know, yeah, it was July 30, 1992, and I haven't found it necessary to pick up a drink or drug since. So I've been really fortunate in that respect.
When you look back, what do you think, what were the elements of your upbringing that created this void that led to the binge drinking?
You know, although my father was sober, and he used to always beat that drum, me and my brother, that, you know, there's alcoholism in our family, and you know, he warned us about it. All, you know, everybody in my family was drinking. So I went to holiday parties, or we were surrounded by it. In my neighborhood growing up, my friends, they wanted to do it. We wanted to be down the tracks. We wanted to be down the beach. We wanted to be down by the barrel fires at the parks. So I was immersed in it, and it was around me. And I had this overwhelming preoccupation with what other people thought of me at that time. And it was almost debilitating. So if my friends were drinking, I'm drinking. If my friends are wearing Nikes, I'm wearing Nikes. If my friends, you know, are wearing a Ralph Lauren jacket, I'm wearing one. So that's some of the things that kind of put me on that path to get, you know, mired in drinking, and then that's what led me, you know, eventually to recovery.
Talk to me about the Gulf War. You deployed there, is that right, when you were in the Army?
Yeah, so I can remember in 1990, when Iraq invaded Kuwait. I want to say it was August 2nd, 1990, if I recall correctly. I was in the 3rd Armored Division, 4th 82nd Field Artillery, Charlie Battery, and we were in Grafenwehr, Hohenfelsen, Germany, training. So our first month was in Grafenwehr. And when we got word that it happened, we were only at the time scheduled for 30 days, and then we got additional orders, go to Hohenfels for another 45 days. So I guess in my mind, I was sense eventually we're going to wind up going over there. Sure enough, Desert Shield evolved. They started, you know, I think they sent the 82nd Airborne. They sent the 24th MAC, and it was December. It was, I think, actually around November, we got word that we would be going too. So 26 December 1990, we went to Saudi Arabia, Dahran, and we waited for, like, I was in artillery, so we waited for M109 Alpha Deuces to come in. You know, when the air war kicked off, you know, there were scuds going through the air and everything, and it was surreal. I can remember being inside a hangar in Dahran, hearing things blow up overhead, being in, like, Mach 4, and thinking, I'm done. Like, one of those scuds are going to come right through that top of that hangar, and I'm just going to be, like, you know, a pile of dust. But that didn't happen, and eventually I got to go into the ground war, which was February of 91. If I remember right, we were just at it for about 4 days. And the enemy was really close too. Like, Republican Guard elements were, like, you know, 4,000 meters downrange, and we were just pulverizing them because the air war had already softened them up significantly. And, you know, they called a ceasefire and we were stunned because we had been told, hey, 14 days of combat, nuclear, biological, chemical environment. Most of the time you'll be in Mop 4. Half of you are going to die. They painted a pretty bleak picture. But I understand why now, because they wanted us to be frosty and just supercharged up and squared away with how we do our job and load rounds into the breach. And all that made us like hyped up. And reflecting on it, it blows my mind, because what we thought was going to happen and how it actually went was significantly different. And I mean, I'm grateful for that, obviously, but it showed me like the ferocity of combat, and just grateful that obviously I made it out of there. And there's a part of me too, like now being into Dharma and Buddhism and meditating, that, you know, I feel like, you know, violence in combat just kind of continues a cycle of violence and confrontation, and it doesn't really solve anything in the long term, if ever.
No, I mean, you look back, I mean, even, you know, I grew up in the, you know, 70s and 80s, and we had Catholics and Protestants killing each other in Ireland, and obviously you had the loyalists and loyalists and Republicans, I don't know if I'm labeling them right, but, you know, the pro and anti UK, and, you know, and it's understandable, you know, you reverse engineer and you go back to the division of Ireland and the, you know, the potato famine and back and back and back. And then you look at our involvement that created some of the issues in Iraq. And then you look at, you know, Afghanistan, and it just keeps, you know, perpetuating. And I think what's sad is that more often than not, an entire country is labeled like, you know, oh, the entire country of Russia must want to invade Ukraine. And it's like, no, I'm sure most of them just want to get on with their lives and, you know, watch their kids grow up. But, you know, until we have, I think, a national awakening as a nation, where these tyrants kind of poke their head up and we just cut their head off straight away, like, nope, you're not going to be another Hitler. You know, it's going to keep happening over and over again, you know. But when we look back at history, I mean, the lessons are so glaring, they're so obvious, and yet we seem to just allow them to perpetuate over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm not here to convert anybody to Buddhism or Dharma, but I think what I've learned in my brief time doing it, about 5 years now, that, you know, it was reflected on in Pali Canon by the Buddha, that, you know, the world is consumed with greed, hatred, and delusion, and that repetitive clinging and craving for pleasant sensations or wealth or materialism is the root of all suffering. And I feel like it's the only philosophy that, you know, I feel like there's truth in it. And in my own direct experience, lived experience in life, like you, kind of bemoaning like that repetitive, you know, combat and fighting, and it just doesn't really get us anywhere. It just sets the table for more fighting and more problematic occurrences. And I think that's why I've really found like a refuge in Buddhism, to kind of live skillfully and more mindfully and just try to pay forward what I can in life and do the good in front of me.
Absolutely. So you talk about Iraq. One of the places I know that people struggle is the transition from, you know, one of our professions, away from that tribe. So obviously you've got that tight-knit tribe that you've forged in the US Army, you know, you fight together side by side. Talk to me about the transition out of the military, and then how, you know, was that jarring for you, or did you find another tribe in the fire service pretty quickly?
Yeah, there was some difficulty like coming back home. for sure, ETS and out. And then, like, really having a bad booze problem. I can remember low crawling in blackouts in my kitchen. I can remember having dreams about, you know, Scud's impact in base camp, all sorts of stuff. So there was definite difficulty, like, coming back home. And there was a big reluctance to speak to that because, you know, I was, you know, in the military, and even, like, you know, on my block, it was like, you know, you don't talk about shit. You know what I mean? You just keep a stiff upper lip, just keep moving at all costs, and we don't talk about feelings around here. So that was still in play back then. And I think when I got to recovery, I softened a lot, and I started to have more receptivity to different ideas and increase my internal bandwidth. And when I did eventually get onto the fire service, drill school was very, the feeling of drill school and that close-knit, all of us, you know, firefighters on probation, PTing, you know, having cadre again to teach us evolutions and fire suppressions, hazmat, EMS. That felt like home again. It felt very, very similar to being in boot camp again. So, yeah, I mean, there was, I landed in a place that was familiar. And I think in the fire service, you know, it is like a family, and it extends worldwide, and we all get each other. And I'm really grateful to be a part of it. And I seen it extend beyond being a firefighter. When I got involved with Dropkick Murphys and the Street Dogs and went touring, like, people from the job were coming out with unicorns and things like that. And, you know, although I had, like, gone on a leave of absence for the job, it didn't feel like I was that far away.
What were the tools that worked for you to become sober when so many people struggle and, you know, fall off the wagon multiple times?
I think the thing that, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, where I went, talked about was to kind of get in touch with a higher power. And, you know, even though I practiced the philosophy of Dharma and Buddhism and meditate and walk that path, I feel like I still believe in the higher power of my youth too, Jesus Christ. And I read that was, you know, and at first there was a heavy amount of skepticism when they said, you know, pray for yourself, pray for them. Like, I was just like, I just didn't believe it. I was extremely angry. But I tried it because I was desperate, and it worked. So I think it's that spiritual connection that enabled me to stay sober, and then attendance at meetings. Like, I think the one thing I've done right in Alcoholics Anonymous is not pick up a drink and never stop going to meetings. I've found that a lot of people that I knew that got away from meetings, they wound up picking up. And sometimes they didn't come back. And unfortunately, some of them, you know, passed away. So I think the thing that enabled me to stay was to kind of try to do the good in front of me and keep it in the day, like AA talks about. And then, I mean, later on down the line, you know, when I seen addiction manifest in other ways, I got involved in refuge recovery. And I got in that. Oh, and I got involved in Buddhism and Dharma, and then found the meditation piece. And that really helps me with everything, because I feel like every moment, thought, mood, sensation, everything is all part of grist for the mill for Dharma, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, we were talking before I hit record. I interviewed a guy he was a very successful businessman in the UK, and he's got a thing called one year, no beer. He himself found sobriety, and he was just trying to change the way it was going to be a message to people. And it was more about changing a relationship with alcohol rather than saying, I'm never going to drink again. And just talking to him, something tripped in my mind. And I was never a binge drinker, but I was a frequent drinker, you know, two or three in the evening to, I'm doing air quotes now, wind down, knowing damn well that it upsets your sleep, not the opposite. And yeah, 2.5 months, and it's just that change. But what I've done is I've put in more exercise, you know, more, I've started meditating, doing the Headspace more diligently, using New Calm, and just taking away that underlying kind of anxiety or whatever that thing was. And I found that non-alcoholic beers now, every so often, if I have a taste for IPA, I'll have a 0% alcohol IPA. And it's like, oh, I just wanted the drink. I didn't want the alcohol. So for me, you know, some people, it's like you said, the cultural habitual thing. That's a very, very strong element too. Some are literally drinking to sleep, to forget, to feel, you know, and that's the more extreme. But a lot of us are, you know, the more social drinkers, you're still damaging your body, poisoning your body. So replacing that with an actual healthy way to downregulate has been amazing for me.
Yeah, that seems like a more skillful means to bring Headspace app in, on board, and meditation. And I found with meditation in my own direct experience that all the feelings I have, thoughts, moods, sensations, emotions, are impermanent. And if I can say yes to the life that's here, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and realize that this too shall pass, and breathe and use mantras like here, now, let go. And I've found that that's a way to kind of to de-escalate a discursive mind or cultivate some ease and some calm and some regulation. So I really feel like, you know, again, like meditation is a skillful means. And I think that you've heard about it being able to change neural pathways and to make people respond more skillfully as opposed to, you know, reacting. And that helps a lot on the job as a firefighter when you're dealing with very, very stressful things, medicals, hazmats, fires. And I've dealt with some people that have had difficulties, you know, where, you know, you go into cardiac arrest situations, or, you know, kids in medicals, and people have been able to kind of just breathe and be in the moment, and then have, you know, some compassion for the people they're dealing with. And because I think one of the things that happens with the fire service is it becomes like, it's not a big deal for us to go into those situations. It's, to us, it's just another day at work. But, you know, to the people that are going through it, it's the worst day of their entire lives. So, I don't know, I feel like keeping that in mind, it has been something that has been a benefit to me in trying to kind of pay that forward to other people too.
Yeah, I used to use box breathing a lot when we were going to, you know, the bigger calls. And then even I remember one time I was handed a limp baby, like right when we pulled up to the curb, and, you know, kind of getting in that stress state. And it was taking a few breaths and then remembering ABCs, the most basic algorithm that we're taught that you don't even think of twice as a medic normally. But, you know, someone blindsides you, and all of a sudden, that breathing, and then just back to the basic things that you've taught. Okay, airway breathing, here we go. And then, you know, you try and save this little one up. This is an abuse case, so there was no saving it. But I mean, that it's not just about down regulation, it's also performance. You know, if you are breathing and getting into that pseudo flow state, you are going to be more effective on a primary search or figuring out, you know, cardiac, you know, algorithms on a PED.
Yeah, 100%. Like box breathing is, I took this mindfulness-based stress reduction course through Mindful Leader, and MBSR is something that Jon Kabat-Zinn came up with in the 70s, and it's derivative of Buddhism, and mindfulness is derivative of Buddhism, something the Buddha, you know, discovered on his, in Bodh Gaya 2,600 years ago, and box breathing was something we were taught too. And with first responders getting rest or rehab or focusing in on work, like, and not letting anxiety overwhelm you. If you go into a fire, you're going into a tough medical situation, is super, super helpful, because you can kind of be where your feet are at and be more ready to respond with competency instead of letting anxiety, like, you know, get you out of sorts.
Well, this is what's funny as well. I'd never thought of this really until I started the podcast, and I was talking to, you know, people about breath work and meditation and obviously fitness. And then you realize we're one of the only professions on the planet where the only air available to us is the tank on our back. And so your cardiovascular fitness and your, you know, your mindfulness, basically the stress mitigation, are both directly related to how many breaths you take and how long that tank lasts. But you go to Fire Academy, and I remember I'm teaching skip breathing. I used to use that a lot, which is very helpful, but that's about it. It's just one fleeting discussion on that's really, you know, making your tank last. But, you know, your fitness makes your tank last, and then your mindset. You know, if you are not in a panic state and you're efficient climbing those stairs and, you know, taking very deliberate breaths, and when it comes to, you know, forcing a door and realizing there's a kid in there somewhere, now you've got, you know, that extra bit. But as I had with one of my guests in the Grenfell fire in London, and I'm not saying that he wasn't fit or mitigating his air, but when it came to the fire floor, they only had enough air to turn around and come back down again. Now, it was untenable at that point. So there's, you know, based on his report, there was no chance anyone was alive anyway. But, you know, imagine if you were deconditioned and you were stressed and you made it to the fire floor and you had to turn around because you were about to tap out, and that child died. You know, this is not just down regulation and our mental health. This is also flow state and performance.
Yeah, it's relative to job performance. And yeah, if you can control your breathing and be where your feet are at and be in the moment and not be hijacked, not have the mind be hijacked by anxiety, you're in a much better place to efficiently and exceptionally perform duties. I mean, with you know, life safety on the fire ground, like pulling people out of buildings or working people on the way out or out front, you know, these, you know, box breathing, meditation, mindfulness-based stress reduction, these things are, you know, they'll help you off the job, but more importantly, I feel like they'll help you, like, do the job skillfully.
100%. Well, you mentioned the Jam, the Clash, Sex Pistols. So you're thinking about, you know, you're relating with this music and you're analyzing it as a young man. Talk to me about Dropkick Murphys and Street Dogs and how that kind of intermingled with your fire service career.
So, you know, I left the Dropkick Murphys to get on the Boston Fire Department, and I got on and was on for about 3 years. And a friend of mine, Jeff Erna, who was the original drummer for Dropkick Murphys, called me up and said, Rob Godotti, who was a friend of ours, he's a friend of the guys in the Murphys too, has some songs and he keeps bringing your name up. Do you want to come down and check them out? I was like, sure. Just casual about it, no big deal. We start working on the songs. We do a demo. And, you know, the band originally was, you know, Rob Godotti, Michelle Paulus on bass, and then Jeff on drums. And then Michelle left the fold, and you know, I called up Johnny Rio to come on board, and that infused a lot of life into the Street Dogs. And, you know, us messing around, like it being poker night or casual, you know, we did a couple shows. And then this is like early 2000s when, you know, music could get onto the internet. And, you know, I wasn't thinking about that at the time. So the demo got onto the internet. And all of a sudden we have record deals coming at us. And I was stunned. I didn't expect that at all. And it was a difficult decision to, like, leave the fire service to pursue Street Dogs full time. But I think one of the things that, I think recovery gave me confidence that if I wanted to go back to the fire service, I could. And I never wanted to, I don't think I ever wanted to be on a porch when I was older, like woulda, coulda, shoulda. That was my mindset. And, you know, pursued Street Dogs full time, and we did 6 studio albums, and it was amazing. Like, we traveled the world, and, you know, we connected with a lot of people. And recently we just did a sold out reunion show at the Middle East last Thursday night, and we were on the Punk and Drum Book Festival Saturday. Like, NOFX is having their final farewell tour. We played that. So I was able to come back to the fire service in 2016, and I'm still a member, and I feel like with the band we can play shows here and there, and I'm really, really fortunate to be able to have been on the job and then do music and still be on the job. Yeah, a lot of that's attributable to recovery. That's just my feeling of where I land with it.
What were the negative influences of, you know, what we would caricature, oh my God, let me try and spit this word out. The caricature would be the rock and roll lifestyle. So you have someone who's sober around, you know, I'm assuming some alcohol, drugs, depending on the crowd situation. You know, did you find yourself kind of being against the grain a little bit, or were you surrounded by other people that were also living a sober lifestyle, and it was easier than we think?
I think on the road, you know, I would go to meetings, and in music, it's you either find people that are completely mired in booze and drugs, or you know, you'll find people that are sober. So as it turned out, like, I would always, like, gravitate toward people that were sober, be it other bands or crew members, and go to meetings. So I always stayed connected, you know? So I was fortunate in that respect.
Talk to me about doing something outside the fire service, because as we, you know, learn more and more and more about the struggles, and we mentioned about the transition from the military, one of the things that I see as a reoccurring theme is a lot of firefighters get to the end of their career and they transition out, and they're like, okay, well, I guess I'll just go teach at a fire academy now. You know, cops transition, they go do security. You know, the military, a lot of times, will go into the contracting. So they view it as like, well, all I can do is firefighting, so I'm going to go teach firefighting. The reality is, you know, you work as a team, you work under high stress, you're a problem solver, there's all these great attributes, and you're also a human being first. So in your case, you are a firefighter and you are a musician, you know, and those two things, you know, can exist perfectly. And there's times where you prioritize one more than the other, and, you know, it's dynamic. So, but there's this kind of, you know, all I should be is a firefighter. And I go to all the conferences and, you know, I wear t-shirts all the time. You know, it becomes a complete identity, which I think is very unhealthy. There has to be a line where, you know, you're also a husband and a wife and, you know, all the other things too. And there's a balance. So you've kind of walked the walk in this. You know, there was times where you're like, okay, the music at this moment is an opportunity I can't turn down. I adore the fire service, but I'm going to step away for a bit, then I'll go back. So talk to me about that entire philosophy, because it's not often that you hear people with, and I would say, use the word courage, the courage to step away from a profession where it's frowned upon to step away from the profession.
So again, like recovery was a big part of having like the confidence and self-esteem to do that. And, you know, I was fortunate to be able to leave the fire service, do music, and then come back to the fire service. And I like how you're framing this up, because I don't want the job to be my 100% identity. I've never wanted that. And, you know, on weekends, I teach mindfulness at a peer recovery place on Saturday. I teach it Sunday at a substance abuse use treatment center. And intuitively, I already sense that when I'm, you know, eventually retire from the job, I would move in that direction to kind of, you know, continue to do that type of teaching, or even maybe potentially be a therapist. So I don't ever want to be like the person that made the job 100% of their identity in all facets of their life. Like, I want to be able to turn it off, and recovery helps me to be able to turn it off. Meditation helps me to be able to turn it off.
Beautiful. Well, I want to get to the communications, and then we'll get to your role now. But just before we do, when you were actually on a rig responding to calls as a firefighter specifically, when you look back, what were some of the career calls that you had?
I think one thing that comes to mind immediately was a 6-alarm fire in East Boston, where three buildings were, you know, fully engulfed, and, you know, it was a long stand, and like a lot of guys I went to drill school were at that fire, and we got pulled out of the building like before it started to kind of like floors and roofs and stuff like that caved in. So kind of felt like a close call on that one. Another one's kind of comical. I remember going to a medical in the Chinatown section of Boston, and somebody had OD'd. And this, I was brand new at the time, and you know, they had a shopper in their arm and everything, and Boston EMS rolled in and hit them with Narcan, and they killed right up, and they went to battle with me and another guy from Engine 10. And when we got back to the station, they were playing the Rocky music over the PA and everything. I mean, there's so many like different types of calls. I remember like going to Engine 16, you know, having been on Engine 10 for 2 years, then going over to Engine 16. And my second day, we had a fire. And, you know, my lieutenant, I was on the pump, you know, the pump operator engineer, you know, before he even got into the building, he had a 2.5-inch line, and he was like, looked at, you know, he didn't even go over the radio. He made eye contact with me, and then, you know, I opened it up, and I've had a 2.5-inch charge line in a building, and that is heavy. He was a bull to get that thing up, like, up to the second floor. Like, to this day, I don't know how he did it. But, I think about stuff like that comes to mind. I think about how today, that, like, you know, safety chiefs are smarter about when people should take off SCBA, like during overhauling. And things are way more mindful and considerate of health and welfare and occupational cancer on the job. You know, I missed a huge fire at an Edison plant in South Boston. I remember swapping off a tour, and and there was a huge nylon fire there, and there were like PCBs in the building, and a lot of people I know got sick and cancer. Some had died from that fire. And initially, I remember feeling like I had this, I don't know, I was like, I should have been in there side by side with everybody in the battle, you know. But now I think I have a different mindset. Like, I guess I was fortunate that it didn't wind up going in there, because it's very likely, you know, I might not be talking to you right now.
Yeah. Yeah, this is, I mean, I was talking to Sam, your union president, a while ago. He was on the show.
Sam, great. Sam Dillon is a great, great union president.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was a great, great conversation. But we were talking about this because I remember your department being one of the first ones when it came to cancer specifically, and you're doing those beautiful documentaries on, you know, people that were struggling, people that you lost. And again, this is another thing with the sleep deprivation side and the shifts, is that's also a carcinogen. So we were going, you know, talking about this, like, you know, deconning the gear and putting plyma vents over engines and not having your ice maker in the bay. I mean, these are all completely pertinent, but also the rest and recovery. You know, the body has the ability to fend off cancer if it's in homeostasis, but if it's broken down and the immune system is working on fumes, then that's where we're a lot more likely to respond to these carcinogens as well. So it's like this, you know, double pronged conversation that we need to be having.
I agree. And I feel like Sam, you know, even like the general president, you know, Eddie Kelly, have really amplified this issue and have put forward things that we, you know, would help the membership, the IAFF membership, firefighters all over the U.S., particularly that some of the bunker gear that's has chemicals in it that, you know, could be carcinogenic or cancerous. So I'm glad a general president's beating that drum. I'm glad there's been changes, but there still needs to be more changes, and I'm confident that stuff will eventually happen.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well then talk to me about communications. That is a group of men and women that I think are the unsung heroes, and I think that we forget that when you and I respond to a call, let's say it's an extrication, you know, we get off, we pull power units, we're operating tools, the stress is offloaded by our physical exertion. You know, we're outside and all the things. And then we can kind of talk about it as we're putting all the gear away and cleaning stuff up. You have someone who's on the end of the phone. And I had an amazing conversation with Beth Bowersox, who was one of the dispatchers for the Paradise Fire in California, the wildfire that killed, you know, a huge amount of people. And they're in a dispatch center. They're sitting there. They've got no way of knowing how it, you know, what the conclusion was. They've got no physical exertion. So all that is just pent up. They're, you know, arguably probably going to work when it's dark, leaving when it's dark. So there's all these factors that really aren't discussed when it comes to our dispatchers. So coming from the field, you know, in operations, what was that kind of experience for you going into the communication side?
So the first thing that comes to mind is, you know, working in fire alarm and dispatch and 911 as a 911 operator as well. You know, medicals, central station alarms, things that are just what happened with some frequency during the course of a shift. You know, 1 a.m. comes and things have quieted down somewhat. And then you get into this, you're like, you get into this lull. And then every terminal lights up at once. And while you're on, and while the other operators are on, you see more calls mounting. You know it's coming. And it's, you know, it's going to be a fire, or it's going to be, you know, attack rescue of some sort. The amount of adrenaline and control chaos that goes on in that room during these incidents, and people yelling at each other to make sure we don't miss something. And after it all winds down, it's difficult to wind down. So, you know, a lot of operate food was a thing that, you know, a lot of it, we called it the, you know, we called it the dispatcher spread. I remember being in my first 2 years, I put on my 25 pounds, you know, because, you know, sweets, you'd be so worked up still over being engaged in an incident like that, that you needed something. So that was problematic. And I like how you framed it, that dispatchers and 911 operators are kind of, I feel like there have been times when it felt like it was an afterthought, but I feel like on our job, relative to the Boston Fire Department, that's kind of been amplified and brought forward. We had, you know, IAFF has done a good job of bringing the peer support course to our membership, be it communications or fire suppression, even like civilian employees. And I feel like people are more aware than they were in the past about the type of stress that the dispatchers and 911 operators deal with. And being an employee assistance program counselor and having been in there, like, I can help people in there. And then I feel like there's a willingness of people to speak or seek assistance. And, you know, now that they know that someone who was in that room is on the peer support EAP side, they know that I get it. And I feel like the difficulty of their position and some of the things they deal with or difficulties they deal with, or like it's being looked at, and when they need help, we jump right to it.
Talk to me then about the role you hold now. You know, what is it? I mean, you've obviously got this lived experience. You've got, you know, multiple roles within the fire service. What kind of led you into the role? And then what is the kind of the job description of your title specifically?
Well, it was about 3.5 years ago. The boss at EAP at the time reached out to me and knew I was in recovery for a long time. And being in recovery, I'd helped people outside of the job, getting into treatment and things like that. I think he felt like I would be an asset in being able to do that in our environment, like on the job. So I came down to the Employee Assistance Program Unit and, you know, immediately went into school to get the certifications, all that stuff. And I feel like having been a firefighter before and been a dispatcher, like I kind of sat in a spot that I could help both divisions out. And I think I spoke to this somehow earlier in a way. There seems to be more receptivity or willingness for members to come forward and speak and seek help, where in the past, you know, it was like, suck it up, drive on, don't say shit. And I feel like that is really becoming a thing, going the way of the dinosaurs in this day and age. I feel like more people are willing to kind of reach out and seek help. And I'm glad to see that going away. And people taking advantage of seeking help and knowing that it's confidential and knowing that it won't be held against them on the job.
Talk to me about the resources available. When I hear EAP more often than not on this show, with all the, you know, the hundreds of stories I've heard now, EAP is actually a negative. They've gone, you know, they've mustered this courage to finally ask for help. They're given a piece of paper with, you know, 10 phone numbers on. They call, three of them are out of service, and, you know, another two can't see them for 6 months. You know, one of them is a child psychologist, you know what I mean? And so now you've got, then they sit in front of another one who then bursts into tears and says they can't help them and they leave. So this is obviously worst case, which I've heard numerous times. But obviously they're a way of getting, you know, a list of culturally competent clinicians, you know, ideally even without the barrier of money, you know, if people are actually employing their own clinicians. But I think that's the problem, is that we've been talking about, oh, let's remove the stigma, but we haven't addressed, well, how do we get from person struggling to person healthy, you know, with this increasingly immense toolbox that's actually available. So what is the model that you use in Boston?
I think what our leadership is pretty progressive. My boss has a really progressive vision with this. Visiting the firehouses, speaking with members, you know, putting stuff out over department mail, like having Zoom groups, sort of like engaging the community before things get problematic. I think one of the things we try to invite the members to ponder or consider is it's far better to come to us and get the help that's available. And like you had mentioned, Toolbox, you had mentioned, we have like a vast network of resources at our disposal. We're very, very fortunate. It's much better to come to us than be on the floor with the command staff and be in a jam. So I think we're kind of in a unique position where we're not aligned with the command staff or the union. I mean, we are union members, obviously, but we have to maintain confidentiality and some distance from both. So when people do come forward, they don't feel like it's going to get back to one or the other. And I think there's a right now, you know, and this has just been my direct experience, there's more faith in the EAP probably than I've seen in my career being on the job. And I think what we're trying to do is stay engaged with the membership through classes, Zoom classes. Like, for example, you know, some of our members, you know, have children who are on, you know, the spectrum of autism, neurodivergency. And we offer Zoom classes to them for people to kind of like communicate and find resources so people can kind of like form community and help each other. And, you know, we've set up like mindfulness meditation Zoom classes too. So when we're communicating through, whether it's setting up mindfulness stuff, setting up stuff for you know, families who are dealing with neurodivergency or autism, children on the spectrum, people working with each other, setting up, working with outside, there's a really good Struggle Well. I don't know if you've heard of Struggle Well.
Many times, yeah, from Boulder Press.
Yeah, so we offer our members Struggle Well so that they can speak to other members and about wellness, about fitness. And so when we're doing all this stuff and we're engaging our community, when stuff gets problematic or they need to reach out to us, they've already connected with us. It's like we're not like isolated in some office and they've never spoken to us at all. They see us, they know we're engaged. We're going into the firehouses, reminding people, hey, we're here, dropping off paperwork, dropping off resources, they don't necessarily have to go through us either. They, if they want to do resources on their own, that's all well good as long as they get the help.
What about financially? Have you, because again, a lot of people that they're looking for these counselors, they don't take insurance. You know, some of them are $150, $200 a session. And so now, you know, money becomes an issue as well, another barrier to entry. Have you been able to bring people in network or kind of reduce that barrier so people can actually get the help that they need?
So glad you brought this up. You know, our members typically have good insurance to be able to get plugged into these resources. However, their family members will work with them and some of them don't. So that's when we have to get people enrolled in Mass Health, which is a healthcare service used by the state of Massachusetts, and there's different tiers. Some substance abuse treatment centers, mental health places, fortunately, occasionally will scholarship people in. So we have ways of getting our community into the resources, like the fire service, like all departments, like they have the good, they typically have the insurance to be able to get plugged in. But the family members, we get some difficulty with that, and we find ways to work through it and get them resources. And what also happens is people outside the fire service will use us too, because it's their way of thinking that, oh, they're the fire department. But once they call, you know, people are going to like want to help them. And there's truth in that. So our way of thinking is help anyone we can and try to mitigate any difficulty with, you know, getting people access to treatment. There's a really good foundation in Boston, the Gavin Foundation, and they have substance abuse use treatment centers and sober houses, and we work with them to help people that, you know, might not have the financial wherewithal to get treatment. And they've been very good about helping people out.
I think this is another topic that we really need to take a step back and think about. You know, you have, of course, some people that slip through the net, you know, they come through already with a lot of problems. You know, you ask, well, how was that person when they were in probation? Oh, they were an asshole. Okay, that's a problem child, but I'm not talking about that. The number of people that 10, 15, 20 years into their career, now, you know, there's behavior problems, there's anger problems, there's drinking, there's, you know, whatever it is, and they're terminated. Rather than going, well, how was this person 5, 10, 15 years ago? Oh, God, they were one of the best firefighters that we ever had. Well, then where's the compassion? Clearly, it is the job that's contributing to this downward spiral. We owe it to that person to put them into, like you said, addiction counseling, and, you know, of course, take them off the rig. They can't be on if they're having these issues, but give them the time the same way as if they broke their femur, you know, to get back on track. But I find that, you know, that's still behind the eight ball when it comes to a lot of these conversations, and they're still firing at DUIs and all these things rather than going, okay, you know, what is the underlying problem here? What are we missing? Because this person wasn't always like this, and it's happened during their time in our department.
Relative to the Boston Fire Department, the command staff and the job historically since the inception of EAP around 1982, I feel like they've always held a lot of space for getting people the help they need. And now, particularly now, there's a desire to, however we can help this person, we should. And that's not to say that there haven't been contentious cases of people being terminated and stuff like that in the past. I'm not trying to say that. Of course, things like that have happened. But moreover, like for the most part, it's been my direct experience that that on our job, when we get the people the help they need, and that's been the culture. And I feel like that our job was, or our department was, along with Chicago, was pretty much it was the beginning of EAPs on fire departments in the U.S. So, you know, as time's gone on, there's been more and more open-mindedness and compassion. That's a very, very skillful word to use to speak to it. Because this job, as you know, there's a lot of stress and difficulty with it. And, you know, people use maladaptive ways to deal with that. And when that happens, if we can get them plugged into the resources that can show them that there's skillful ways to deal with the stress of this job, then they'll be better off for it moving forward.
100%. I've said this a lot recently. I think what we need to do is put the hope into the mental health conversation, that when you have gone through, just like you in this conversation, you know, the other side of your sobriety, now here you are, you know, teaching meditation and mindfulness and, you know, head of the EAP program, and that came from your struggles. So that post-traumatic growth, that resilience that is forged by working through that trauma needs to be the messaging, you know. But if you just terminate someone, you know, then you're missing an opportunity to get that person not back on their feet, but even stronger. And so many people that have come on here that have got to that point, then they become a beacon of light for others. And others come out the shadows saying, I was hurting. I how did you do this? I've been going through this. I can't get myself out. And then that not only helps that person now that's come to them, but it's a kind of, you know, self-licking ice cream, as it were, because that ability to help others is healing for the individual that's going through their own recovery journey as well.
Yeah, just point of clarification. I'm a member of the EAP. Like, my boss is Brian Nee. And I agree with you that when people get vulnerable or amplify recovering or behavioral health or wellness, there's a strength in vulnerability. And instead of excoriating or vilifying people when they've had problematic behavior, I feel like it's more skillful to kind of to have a compassionate lean on it and try to get people help. I mean, if you look at the fire service, the whole idea is predicated on helping people.
Absolutely.
So why not help our own people?
100%. 100%. Well, I want to be mindful of your time. I've got some closing questions if you've got time for those.
I do.
Brilliant. The first one I love to ask, is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
So I feel like one of the greatest books I've ever read, and it's from Tara Brach. Radical Acceptance is a wonderful book. And that's, you know, just a brief synopsis on that. It's about saying yes to the life that's here, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, and just having, accepting that we're feeling beings and that moods, thoughts, sensations, and things are always changing. And I feel like flow's been mentioned a couple times in our conversation, and when we flow with experience instead of contesting it, I feel like it's more skillful. And Tara Brach does a really good job of illuminating that and explaining it not in an esoteric way, but just in a really like basic, straightforward way.
Beautiful. What about films and or documentaries?
Wow. Films and documentaries. I really feel like the documentary about Bill W., the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, is really, really good. I believe that's on Amazon Prime. That's something that comes to mind right away.
Yeah, I watched that too. It was amazing.
Yeah, it's good.
All right. Well, the next question, is there a person that you recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military, and associated professions of the world?
Yeah, Nako Nolan.
I got to get him back on. We actually talked about it, but he likes doing it in person, so I got to get him back.
Oh, he's already been on?
Yeah, yeah, I had him on. It's been, God, I think about 3 years now, something like that. But he came to the house. It was awesome. But I need to get him back on. There's so much more to discuss.
Well, he retired.
Yeah, so he'll be a lot more. But I think he's gone back in. Is he retired again now? I think he went into law enforcement, but maybe he stopped that for the second time. I forget. But yeah,
You know who might be good, James, is Danny O'Connor from House of Pain might be good.
I had Danny on as well.
Okay.
And Josh Stewart Shore from Boston, he's been on as well.
Okay. I'm thinking of those guys straight away. I can't really think of anyone that comes to mind immediately.
Yeah, well, let me know if you do. But yeah, I'm running a marathon in Tulsa, and I know that Danny's got the Outsiders house there, so I'm hoping while I'm over there I can go visit the house.
Oh, check out the museum. Yeah, yeah. I wanted to do that too, because I love the book by S.E. Hinton and then the movie by Francis Ford Coppola. That movie is American cinematic like perfection.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, we've been kind of talking about this for part of the conversation, but what do you do to decompress?
Again, I'm going to sound like a broken record, but it's just meditation. I try to meditate at least once a day, sometimes twice. Listening to music will help me decompress too. Just like sitting in the living room, listening to like spinning a good record. Lately I've been listening to Hot Water Music, this new album Vows, which is incredible. So that'll help me decompress. Going for walks, with my girlfriend is really helpful too, because that's a mindful activity. You know, so been doing like a lot of walking, and it feels like a skillful means to obviously for fitness, cardiovascular fitness, but just kind of like to decompress and, you know, just enjoy, you know, the beauty of nature too.
100%. I walk my dog twice a day and I always leave my phone in the house. So that's, you know, like 30, 40 minutes each time of just, you know, me and my German Shepherd. She doesn't speak English, so, you know, we have to be quiet and, moving meditation. All right. Well, then the very last question, if people want to find you online, where are the best places?
I have an Instagram site. It's Dharma Practice. So if they just put Dharma Practice in, they would find it. And my name's underneath it, Michael McCombie.
Beautiful. Well, Michael, I want to say thank you so much. I mean, we've covered a bunch of topics. Obviously, when you're going in, you're like, oh, we're going to talk about rock music all the time. And, you know, like I said, the rock and roll lifestyle, but this is what I love is these are things that human beings do. And what actually happened is obviously this very spiritual journey of recovery and all the different roles that you've held, you know, in a firefighter's uniform in bunker gear. And then now I would argue as a force multiplier, helping the rescuer, helping the firefighters. So I want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
No, James, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. And I look forward to listening to it back. And, you know, really grateful to have been able to be of service and just talk about my direct experience.